This is a podcast from 2MBS Fine Music Sydney.
Hello, I'm Simon Moore. Welcome to In Conversation on 2MBS Fine Music Sydney. Today's program has been recorded at the Australian Festival of Chamber Music in Townsville. I'm delighted to be here as a guest of the festival, and it's been quite an extraordinary experience as some of the finest musicians in Australia, and indeed the world, come together, and the result is truly sensational. And the festival brings other leading artists too, for talks and presentations, and to be part of the festivities. One of them for this year's festival is recognised as one of Australia's greatest writers. David Malouf has been publishing acclaimed novels, short stories, poetry, plays, opera librettos for over 50 years. He's the recipient of countless awards, most notably the International Dublin Literary Award for Remembering Babylon in 1996, the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award in 2008, and in 2016, the Australia Council Award for Lifetime Achievement in Literature. He's also a great lover of fine music, so I'm delighted he's taken time out from enjoying the festival to be in conversation with me today. David Malouf, welcome to 2MBS Fine Music Sydney.
Thank you, Simon.
Now, you are a writer, but we find ourselves together at a chamber music festival. This genre of music is an important part of your life?
Yes, I've always been interested in chamber music. I learned the violin when I was a kid and played quite a lot until I was 16 or 17.
You didn't have aspirations to take it further?
I wanted to be a performer at that time, thought that's what I was going to do. When I was 12, I was a member of the Brisbane Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra, so I had, you know, some experience of that. Then I wanted to be a composer.
Ooh.
Then I wanted to be an actor, but I eventually found that I was a writer.
So writing was the third or fourth career choice.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, you know, that's a very unpublic performative art, really.
Yes.
Whereas all the ones that I had had my eye on before that, except the composing, were performative. So it's quite interesting to me that I made that clear choice that I didn't want to be out there in front of an audience. I wanted to do it all in private.
Yes. I mean, well, you're sort of out in front of an audience now and you will be at the festival. Is that, do you find that sort of thing an outlet for your performative side? Or has that kind of been put away?
I think my performative side went into teaching.
Yes.
That was enough. But look, certainly as my writing career went on, the need to actually appear, you know, became more and more frequent. But I make a very clear distinction between my visible self and my public self and the writing self, which I think is something very, very different.
Oh, yes.
And that you discover only in the writing. I think it's very difficult for me as a writer to present to people what it is that they have previously formed a relationship with, usually, which is the writing self.
So can you elaborate on that a bit more in terms of the presentation of the two selves?
Well, I think there's a walking and talking self. That's, you know, what we all have. And then the writing self comes from somewhere much more mysterious. It's unknown, I think, to the writer until it appears on the page. And that, for me, is what is the most important part of writing and the greatest satisfaction of writing, is that I discover my real identity on the page. And that's as much a revelation to me and a surprise as I hope it is to an audience.
Fascinating.
You know, people who read it.
Yes.
So I make a really clear distinction between what belongs to my daily life and what belongs to my inner life. And the other thing that I think is just we forget, that we actually, all of us, spend one third of our lives in another place, which is sleep. And what the experience we derive from that, the drama that we go through there, has different rules. It belongs to a different level of consciousness, all of us. And I think that's what writers very strongly draw on.
Do you listen to music whilst writing, or do you need to do that in silence?
Never listen to music when I'm writing, and have never wanted to, because I think writing demands your full attention. But as far as I'm concerned, so does music.
Yes.
And I really only ever want to sit down and have nothing in my mind except what the music brings to it. I'm also really, these days, much more finicky about the music I listen to. I mean, I mostly don't want to listen to music to be entertained. I want to listen to music to be taken somewhere. So I'm inclined to sort of, as I say, be a bit finicky about that. And also, the kind of music that matters most to me is live music. I really want to be in an audience. I really want to have the sounds coming to me, and I do the mixing, not somebody in a recording studio. And I love that. And I also love the visual thing of that, that watching how the music, for example, physically moves through space around a group, for example, and the interaction of the group. All that's very, very much for me part of the pleasure of listening to music. And that's why I really like coming to festivals.
Mm. Well, that, I think, leads us to our first choice, which is a bit of Bach. Can you tell us what this is and where does this piece take you?
Oh, look, Bach is just astonishing for me. The Bach Mass, for example, once I discovered it, became one of my absolutely favourite pieces of music and something I would play over and over again. And all the preludes and fugues on the harpsichord. But, of course, the one which is just most extraordinary is the ones for organ. And I could have chosen many, many different ones, but this one is, I think, one of the absolute grandest. And I love that kind of insistence of the motif on which the fugue is based. I think nobody writes music that is nobler than Bach. And other people who, I think, try it later, they don't do it as convincingly as Bach does.
Thank you.
J.S. Bach, Passacaglia and Fugue in D minor, BWV 582, performed by organist Helmut Walcher, the first choice of my guest in conversation today, the writer David Malouf. David, you were born in Brisbane, which is also quite evocatively portrayed in your first novel, Jono, which is said to be a semi-autobiographical work. How much emphasis do we place on the semi?
Oh, you know, when I was, soon after I wrote the book, I used to go out quite often to schools to talk about the book, and the questions often would be, did this really happen? And my answer, my stock answer to that became, yes, when I was writing it. And I think that's one of the great things that you discover in writing a book which uses the first person in that way, that you either take a situation which really did happen, and you write it in the most effective way, which largely means changing it so that anybody else who was there would say, that's not what really happened, that's not the way it was. Or you actually make up things which didn't happen, but which you hope will be so convincingly imagined that people won't recognize won't feel any difference between what was fiction and what was real memory.
Mm. One review I saw called it the most achingly nostalgic novel I've read. Is that something you consciously aim for, that sense of nostalgia? Because that does come across in your other writing as well. Or is it just something that emerges?
I think that was something that just emerges. And in fact, I think of myself as being a quite abstracted and critical in an awful lot of that, because it's largely a kind of give and take between two characters who are opposite and who are always in any situation seeing things differently. So there's an argument through most of it of positive and negative. So again, when people kids used to ask me, you know, is this novel about you? I used to say, if you mean, am I the Jono character? Yes.
So what about an imaginary life? I mean, that's, you said that's in some regards your most autobiographical book, even though it's about the Roman poet Ovid. Is that kind of the same principle again?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's what you discover there that tells you something about yourself, something about an identity that you're still in process of making. Because again, I think, I really find very, very, very uncomfortable the kind of insistence on identity which we go on with these days. I would really want to say is I don't have an identity to myself that belongs, say, to Australia or Queensland. What it belongs to is the language I use. Now, that language is an Australian version of English, and I don't have to put on any performance to prove that I'm an Australian. It's something that exists in the whole way I face the language and the way I was educated and used the language. But apart from that, writing for me, I think, has always been about trying to discover who I am, you know, in all sorts of areas that I myself am not conscious of, but which the writing, in as much as you go into an unconscious self, reveals to you.
Mm. The start of all great writers is almost always as a reader. Were you an advanced reader as a child?
Yeah, I could read before I knew it. I mean, I went to school early because they wanted to get me out of the house, and I couldn't go to a state school, so I went to a dame school. I wasn't old enough to go to a state school, so my mother found a woman who just taught children in her house, and I spent the first of my 5 years of education there. But I could read before I could write. And it was very interesting to me. Recently, I was thinking about writing, and I was remembering learning to hold the slate pencil, as it was in those days, and write on the slate, and the first pothooks you made. And I realized what a painful business learning to write was, and how unconsciously I had learned to read. And it made me question what we mean when we look back at times and say that women, for example, in the Gothic period, the Elizabethan period, were illiterate. What we really mean is that they couldn't write. They didn't need to write, but they could read. And there's a huge gap between reading and writing, which we don't always take care about.
So what were the works that you were drawn to as a child, you know, perhaps a little bit later than those very early years?
Oh, almost immediately, the novel. I had dengue fever because I was growing up during the war, and American soldiers made up the largest part of Brisbane's population, and they kept going to the tropics and coming back. They brought dengue with them. And when I was 9, I got dengue fever and was sort of locked up for 10 days or something. And I remember the book I read then. It was Oliver Twist. So that's not bad for a 9-year-old.
That's pretty
these
good.
These days, you know. But complex sentences was something we dealt with quite easily because we were taught about the structure of complex sentences very early on at school.
Something that's not so complex but is absolutely delightful is your next choice of music, which is one of the most elegant pieces of Chopin that's around. Can you tell us why you've chosen this one and what it is?
I'm very, very interested in the history of Western music because, you know, the piano is a late creation. You know, first of all, there's the virginal, then there's the clavier, then there's the harpsichord, and then there's the pianoforte thing, and then there's that amazing kind of instrument which attempts to rival the complete orchestra, you know, that has appeared by the time that Chopin writes. And those nocturnes and preludes are extraordinary, but the Raindrop Prelude is one of the longest. You know, it's about 4.5 minutes or something, whereas most of the others are 28 seconds or 52 seconds or something. And it's amazingly expressive. And it's got that very, very strong ostinato push to it. I just find that a most wonderfully intense work, whereas a lot of the other preludes are much more demonstrative. And that one is very, very interiorized. Strange that it's got that title, Raindrop. It doesn't seem to me to have anything much to do with it. The title is evoked by that kind of push, that ostinato repeating of the note that you get in it. But it's a wonderfully, wonderfully intense piece of music, but also completely interiorized, which is so much the difference between Liszt, usually, not always, and Chopin. I mean, Chopin is almost always, it's almost always interiorized.
You particularly wanted us to hear Alfred Cortot performing it. This is quite an old recording. Was there a reason for wanting to hear this pianist?
The fact that I had it, and that was where I kind of, you know, when I wanted to listen to the preludes, I went back to those. It's great, great performance. The other person who's wonderful, I think, performer of Chopin is Dino Lupati. And I also have records of those.
Thank you.
Chopin's Prelude in D-flat major, Opus 28, number 15, known as the Raindrop Prelude, an historic recording there from pianist Alfred Courtauld, the choice of my guest in conversation today, writer David Malouf. David, you lived overseas in Britain and in Tuscany for many years. Was there something that drove that relocation?
Oh, I think when I was growing up in Brisbane, it was a wonderful place for a writer to grow up in. We had wonderful childhood. My sister and I, you know, we went to the beach a lot. You grew up as a very sporty person and come outdoors sort of person. When I got into my early 20s, I began to realize what a closed place it was. I mean, partly that was the education. We all went to private schools, and that meant that everybody knew the people in other private schools over the years, and I observed that that's who everybody eventually married, and they went on to have children who sort of knew one another as well. There were only a number of ways your life could go career-wise, and I thought it was too closed. I just wanted to escape to a place which might offer more openings, and Britain was that, really. I mean, apart from the fact that London was always seen as the centre of the cultural world for us, so it was going to where it all originated and where it all happened. But it really was that question of saying to life, you know, okay, deliver me a few options that are not the three options of growing up in Brisbane.
So then what brings you back?
I came back really, I decided that I really wanted to live in England. And I, by that time, I had moved from London to north of England, to Birkenhead and the Wirral. And I really, really wanted to live there. And I came back on a two-year contract to teach at Sydney University, but came back at a particular moment. It was just that moment when Australia was beginning to wake up to everything that had happened already in England in the 60s. Very, very exciting moment.
So what period are you putting this in?
I came back in 1968, and it was a moment of when we were all involved in moral questions about the Korean War.
Vietnam War?
The Vietnam War, sorry, yes, and which I had been very interested in England. But it was also the moment when of female liberation, gay liberation, all of those things were happening. So it was a very... And Australian writing was opening up in a particular kind of way. And I immediately found myself in a world of the 60s, really, poetry revolution in Australian writing and chance to be a public writer. All of that immediately grabbed me, and I was here. And stayed, really, until 1978, when I decided to be a full-time writer, when I had to find some place again where I could do it quietly.
I mean, that period you're talking about, but also extending on into the bicentennial era and sort of then on through the 90s into the Centenary Federation, I mean, I sort of regard of it as a sort of a coming of age of Australia's national identity, sort of emerging from the old cultural cringe. And your book, Remembering Babylon, which is kind of in the early 90s, the New York Times said it was a novel that turns the history and mythic past of Australia into a dazzling fable. And that's an interesting word, dazzling fable of human hope and imperfection. I mean, how do you see the evolution of Australia's national identity throughout your working life and your contribution to it?
There were two things that really happened to my generation. We were the first generation of male Australians who had never had their manhood tested by war. That's one thing. And that kind of hung over my generation as a kind of question. How would I have got through that? Because, you know, before that, our fathers, our grandfathers had all been essentially tested in war. So I wrote a number of books, you know, which are about wars that I didn't have any part in, but which had a huge effect on families and on the lives of Australians. But also, I think, we were starting to ask ourselves questions about what the occupation of the continent meant, both in terms of what it had cost Indigenous people here also in terms of what it meant when you bring a language like English to a landscape and a place that it doesn't naturally derive from, which it's imposed on in a kind of way, and also all that question of what it means to be, first of all, a strong British culture, which provides not only all the methods of social order and government, but also a certain way of seeing the world, which is inherent in the language. What it means to have all of that as the structure that a lot of people who come from other languages and other cultures have to deal with. So very, very, very interesting society to observe as a writer and to try and encapsulate the stresses and failures of.
Well, some more music now, and we're going to the world of opera with, Baroque opera with some Handel. What have you got for us here?
Yes, I mean, it's also one of the most beautiful arias anyone ever wrote. It's not surprising that the greatest of all opera composers, Mozart, you know, looked back and found so much inspiration in Handel. And this is just a wonderful aria. What I'm really, really interested in opera and in an aria like this is singing, and particularly solo singing, is about a use of breath and the control of breath. And we're all essentially breathers. So that is just so close to the essence of life. And this amazing capacity that some people have, and which composers have discovered a way of exploiting, of having control of the voice. And the other thing which is fascinating to me is the way in which certain intervals in music we respond to in a very, very emotional kind of way. And again, you know, arias exploit that. So this one particularly, that first semitone and the repetitions immediately evoke deep feeling, pathos, grief. And that's not just appealing to us, and doesn't just move us, but in the way in which Aristotle talks about tragedy, it kind of purges us of something. And even those of us who've never actually faced these kind of dramatic situations of melancholy or grief or pathos or whatever it is, in the same way as the characters, we do. When we listen to it, I can't think of anything more wonderful than this aria.
Oh.
Extraordinary music there, Lascia Chiopianga from Handel's Rinaldo. Yvonne Kenny, the glorious soprano, and she was joined by the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra, directed by Paul Dyer. The choice of my guest in conversation today, writer David Malouf. I'm recording this at the Australian Festival of Chamber Music in Townsville, where David is, well, both an attendee and part of the festivities, offering an interview or two while he's here. David, I confess that at school I was never a fan of having to read what we were told was literature. For there was so much baggage for me with that term. It was something a bit frightening. Now, I've obviously gotten over it since, but how would you reach out to people who might be reluctant to read, or at least read works regarded as quote-unquote great, whether they're yours or somebody else's?
I think we have to be very careful of how we present these things to young people. Poetry, for example, I think is these days seen as difficult, and teachers find it difficult. They found it difficult when they were kids at school, and they don't like to teach it. One of the ways we were taught poetry seems to me to be essential to it, and that is we learn things off by heart. And we learn things off by heart at 8, 9, 10 that we couldn't possibly have any hope of really fully understanding, even something like Wordsworth's Daffodils. But if you actually learn a poem by heart, what goes into your head and stays there is the music of the thing. And I think we forget how often in poetry the music is as much part of the meaning as the logic of the poem's argument. And I myself was astonished by the way in which, you know, when I looked again at a poem like Wordsworth's Daffodils and that 17 or 18 dealing with its ideas, how much of it I had actually understood at a time when I couldn't possibly understand or be interested in the ideas so much through the music. Mm-hmm. And I think, learning poems by heart is still something I love. I mean, I still do it. But, you know, when I was at school, long time ago, early 40s, you learned off by heart a famous poem almost every week.
Every week?
Every week. Gosh. And that meant that you came away from school with most of the great poems in English, including things like The Ancient Mariner and, as I say, Wordsworth's Daffodils, Shakespeare's sonnets, already in your head.
Even if you don't fully understand.
Even if you don't understand them.
But you think you think memorising them is still a worthwhile exercise.
I do. I know these days it's regarded as a form of child abuse. I think. And in fact, I still say to people, you know, who are struggling, teachers, trying to teach as the first poet they do for the HSC, somebody like Yeats, you know, where will I begin? And I always say to them, get them to memorise an Irish airman foresees his death. And just learn it off by heart. And we'll start with that. And you'll be astonished by the extent to which they've already fallen for the poetry.
So why do you think that tradition of learning things like that? I mean, even in my era, we learned things like our times tables by rote.
Yes, yes.
Same kind of principle, which I don't know that they do now, although I'm sure I can be corrected there. But why do you think that's fallen out of favour, those sorts of traditions?
These are educational theories that what children have to be introduced to is how to think and how to question rather than to accept, things learned by rote. But little kids love that. That's why they love nursery rhymes and why they love skipping rhymes. And I think what the old education simply did was led them very gently on at five from skipping game rhymes, over the garden wall, I let the baby fall. My mother came out and gave me a clout and almost turned me inside out over the garden wall. Even boys loved those skipping rhymes, and they loved all the nursery rhymes as well. Well, they simply applied that childish habit, really, which has been acquired, to the acquiring of, yes, times tables, but also of learning a poem a more complex poem off by heart. That seems to me to be a natural way of leading children into the language. Yes, you know, it's important that they learn to think and question and reject and all the rest of it, but that's another form of thinking than this one.
Interesting. Did you find the way you read other writers has changed, you know, after you'd become a successful writer, developed your own back catalogue, for want of a better expression?
I think that we keep growing. And it's very interesting to go back and read books that we've read before. And sometimes we find that there's so much more there than we knew when we were 12 or 20 even. And sometimes we find that we're no longer interested in the effects of these things. So I think rereading, which I do a lot of, are a wonderful test of how much you've retained and how much you've changed. And I think that's one of the reasons why people do like to go back to books. They expect to find their first self there. They often don't. And I also really like to say that the best books, the second reading is really your first reading.
Yes. one thing we haven't talked about yet are your operas. You've written a few opera librettos. That must have been a very different task. Or was it surprisingly similar?
I had begun going to operas very, very early. I think the first opera I went to was Carmen when I was about 10. And a great moment was the moment of the Mozart bicentenary in 56, when four Mozart operas were done all around Australia by the Elizabethan opera as it was then. And in Brisbane, too, I had a chance to go to all four Mozart operas, but I went to them over and over and over again. So I absolutely fell in love with opera, went to Vienna immediately when I got to Europe and spent a whole season there so I could hear the operas. It was then suggested to me I might write a libretto of Voss, and I came to it with a lot of experience of operas seen and heard. And it's really unique, because what you're doing is taking, as in the case of Voss, you know, a book of something like 300,000 words, or no, you know, it's a big book.
Yeah.
It mightn't be that many, it might be 150,000 words. And you're reducing it to about 3,000 words at the most, probably two. And you also have to take into account that when words are sung, it's difficult for them to be comprehended, and English is more difficult in that way than, say, Italian and even perhaps German.
Oh, really?
Yes, I think our vowel sounds are very, very different and our consonant sounds are very different. So you do have to take into account when you're writing the libretto that the words will be singable, and when they are sung will be apprehensible to an audience. And you also have to consider repetition, because music relies to some extent on repetition. And you know, that's very, very different from writing prose in a story. I was quite fortunate in a way, because I was dealing with someone, in Richard Mille, who was a wonderful composer, but had never written much vocal music. And once I said to him, do you want something that's through written, so it's like conversation, or are you happy with arias and things? And he wanted something much more traditional, like arias. So as the librettist, I found that I was making musical choices for him, like when two people sang together, when three people sang together, when there was a chorus, when there was an ensemble, you know. And that really meant that to me, I was making decisions which a composer might himself want to make, which would make it much harder. But so we had a very, very useful cooperation there. But it's different from every other kind of writing.
It's interesting you make the observation about English being a difficult language to sing. I mean, given the English language is used in popular song around the world,
yes,
not just by native English language speakers, I mean, I assume that's then therefore just the dominance of the English language rather than its musicality.
I think so. I mean, Italian is, you know, has got all those vowel sounds at the end and all this, but and also Italian is a language which finds rhyme very easily, which English again finds rhyme difficult.
When you're, you know, using the work of Patrick White there for Voss, I mean, did you approach that at all with any trepidation at all, you know, to do it justice and so on, or did you feel confident at the time that to stride in and get it done?
Well, Patrick and I were very close.
Yes.
And he had chosen...
That can make it worse, though.
Yeah, he had chosen me as a possible librettist. The thing about Voss which was immediately attractive to me is that a lot of that book and a lot of what people find most difficult in that book is that Voss and Laura, after their first period of meeting very early on, never meet again, but have long, long, long conversations, either in letters which never get sent or simply in dream conversations. And that's odd in a novel, but the opera stage is just made for it because all music happens in space. And so the question of whether the two people are in the same room or even in the same part of the country, it just the problem disappears in music. You know, they can sing duets together, although we know that he is away in the middle of the country somewhere. So it seemed to me that that book was absolutely made to be an opera. So I had less trepidation about that than some later things.
Mm. Well, another track of music now, and well, I'm surprised it's taken us this long to get to him, the music of Mozart, and you've mentioned his operas already. Why have we chosen this one? In fact, this one was performed at the festival on the opening night, I think.
Well, in fact, only one movement.
Oh, only one movement, yes, we're going to hear, actually.
Yeah,
yes.
And not in the form of the Mozart. It was, I think, a sextet or something.
Yes, it was
like
an arrangement,
that.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, look, I think this is one of the most wonderful pieces of music Mozart ever wrote. And it's interesting to me because we sometimes think that a poet or a novelist or a composer bound to write their best things is usually three periods, youthful, middle, and then later. And we expect the later music to provide the great masterpieces. And we've certainly done that with Beethoven, for example, you know, with the insistence on the greatness of the last sonatas, which are great, and the string quartets. Not always true. And most people who are either writers or painters or whatever they are can suddenly do what might be one of their greatest works, either when they're very young. Think of Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream Overture. And I think that's very true of Mozart. And this is, in fact, a very middle period of Mozart's writing, but he never wrote anything more wonderful than this. And in the same way, he never wrote, it seems to me, any more wonderful aria than Ruhe Sanft, you know, which comes very, very early on in that opera called Zaida. So Mozart could be the greatest, at his greatest, or almost any moment in his writing career. This is one of them.
Thank you. The Andante from Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin, viola and orchestra in E-flat. The performance we heard there was from Camerata Academica Salzburg with violinist Augustin Dumay and violist Veronica Hagen. The choice of my guest in conversation today, the writer David Malouf. I'm recording this at the Australian Festival of Chamber Music in Townsville. Now, David, who are the writers that you read now?
I like very much going back to people I've read before. Conrad, Henry James, Tolstoy, anytime. Balzac, who I still think is probably the greatest of all novelists, and Dickens. And, you know, I've just been thinking in these last days, actually, I really want to read Bleak House again.
And, I thought you were going to say Oliver Twist again.
Well, that too. But, you know, writers like that, you go back, as I say, to partly rediscover yourself and to rediscover the changes in yourself. But also, they have such a vast grasp of the world in process, society in process, the economic world, families. And, you know, Dickens, for example, we forget that Dickens was a huge influence on someone like Dostoevsky and on Tolstoy. And the other person I would go back to at any time and pick it up and find I'm reading for the next 6 months would be Proust.
What about new writers?
There are a lot of new writers, and you're very glad to discover them.
Yeah? Is there one that you're particularly fond of at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think new writers come along quite a lot, but somebody I admire very much is Ismail Kadare, an Albanian writer who's just won the Neustadt Award, but I fully expected him to have won the Nobel Prize by now.
Are you always writing, like always observing a world around you or absorbing things, or are you writing now?
I'm not writing any more fiction.
No.
And that's partly because the world is difficult to get into fiction anymore. The things like, you know, our mobile phones and the ease of contact with people takes away an awful lot of the possibilities of plot. And I'm surprised by the number of new books I write by younger people who deliberately set the book in the early 90s because they don't have to deal with all of that. Yeah. But also I think of as my body of work as far as fiction goes is complete.
Right.
I'm not really doing that. But I still write poems, but I don't feel any pressure. I mean, if a poem comes up, I'm very happy to sit down and go through the process of trying to let it happen. But I don't worry about the fact that I'm not writing.
Right. Well, David, before I let you go, you do have one more piece of music to introduce, and that's Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. Why? It's a fantastic piece of music, but why have you chosen it for us today?
It is a very, very beautiful piece of music, and kind of stands alone. I mean, it belongs in a quartet, but we hardly ever hear it in the quartet. Yeah. And I just noticed the number of times it's become a kind of 20th century iconic piece, and especially for all kinds of moments of grief, of memorial. I remember going to a concert at the Sydney Opera House, and it was actually the day after the 9/11. And, you know, they said, we want to commemorate the lives of these people who had been lost. And so they played that. And almost the whole of the audience was in tears. And it's one of those things that music can do, but who produces it and where it happens is often completely unpredictable.
Well, David Malouf, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating chat, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon.
Writer David Malouf. I've been speaking to him at the Australian Festival of Chamber Music, where he's been enjoying the music as an audience member and also entertaining the audience as part of the festival's conversation series. To find out more about the Australian Festival of Chamber Music, head to afcm.com.au. That's all for In Conversation for today. Subscribe to the podcast edition by searching 2MBS In Conversation in your preferred podcast app so you can listen to the program at a time most convenient to you. I'm Simon Moore, and this is 2MBS Fine Music Sydney.